I do ask for rides now and then. I do ask for rides now and then by putting my thumb out for rides that are already running, and I take what is freely offered.
Who is the real Mooch? When we take only what we need, all is balanced. When we take more than we need, this is called greed, theft. Who takes only what he or she needs? Please think deeply on this. I don't even have problems with parasites, but I wouldn't insult parasites by comparing Babylon to them. A parasite drains its host, yet a parasite has a place in nature's balance. Even so, would you call me a parasite? Am I draining my host? I would say Babylon, commercial civilization, is more than a parasite. It's like a cancer which destroys both its host and its own self. Do I impose anything on Babylon? Yet Babylon imposes obscene burdens on most everybody and everything. Babylon has so raped the land and poisoned the water that few places exist in the world where a person could even live off the land or even grow her own clean food if she wanted to. Then Babylon turns around and tells us simple folk that we're dependent on Babylon, should be grateful to it for taking a scrap of food that it doesn't even offer freely, but throws out and puts under lock and key in a dumpster. It's like a thief who steals your house and home, then condemns you for eating a couple of scraps that you've stolen from the home's trash bin. This is exactly what Babylon has done to the Native Americans. Okay, this turned out to be an angry answer. I don't recommend anger, except at rare times. Anger is a part of the universe and must be validated. On rare occasions, we need to stand up from our lives of gentle equanimity and make a whip and take it to the merchants and money changers in the temple. Anger is not effective if we use it all the time, and anger is most effective, in fact powerful, when we use it sparingly.
Chapter 1. Economy, Part 5. One young man of my acquaintance, who has inherited some acres, told me that he thought he should live as I did, if he had the means. I would not have anyone adopt my mode of living on any account. For, beside that before he has fairly learned it I may have found out another for myself, I desire that there may be as many different persons in the world as possible. But I would have each one be very careful to find out and pursue his own way, and not his father's or his mother's or his neighbor's instead. The youth may build or plant or sail. Only let him not be hindered from doing that which he tells me he would like to do. It is by a mathematical point only that we are wise. As the sailor or the fugitive slave keeps the pole star in his eye, but that is sufficient guidance for all our life. We may not arrive at our port within a calculable period, but we would preserve the true course. Undoubtedly, in this case, what is true for one is truer still for a thousand, as a large house is not proportionally more expensive than a small one, since one roof may cover, one cellar underlie, and one wall separate several apartments. But for my part, I preferred the solitary dwelling. Moreover, it will commonly be cheaper to build the whole yourself than to convince another of the advantage of the common wall. And when you have done this, the common partition, to be much cheaper, must be a thin one, and that other may prove a bad neighbor, and also not keep his side in repair. The only cooperation which is commonly possible is exceedingly partial and superficial, and what little true cooperation there is as if it were not, being a harmony inaudible to men. If a man has faith, he will cooperate with equal faith everywhere. If he has not faith, he will continue to live like the rest of the world, whatever company he is joined to. To cooperate in the highest as well as the lowest sense means to get our living together. I heard it proposed lately that two young men should travel together over the world, the one without money, earning his means as he went, before the mast and behind the plough, the other carrying a bill of exchange in his pocket. It was easy to see that they could not long be companions or cooperate, since one would not operate at all. They would part at the first interesting crisis in their adventures. Above all, as I have implied, the man who goes alone can start today, but he who travels with another must wait till that other is ready, and it may be a long time before they get off. But all this is very selfish, I have heard some of my townsmen say. I confess that I have hitherto indulged very little in philanthropic enterprises. I have made some sacrifices to a sense of duty, and among others have sacrificed this pleasure also. There are those who have used all their arts to persuade me to undertake the support of some poor family in the town, and if I had nothing to do, for the devil finds employment for the idle, I might try my hand at some such pastime as that. However, when I have thought to indulge myself in this respect, and lay their heaven under an obligation by maintaining certain poor persons in all respects as comfortably as I maintain myself, and have even ventured so far as to make them the offer, they have one and all unhesitatingly preferred to remain poor. While my town's men and women are devoted in so many ways to the good of their fellows, I trust that one, at least, may be spared to other and less humane pursuits. You must have a genius for charity, as well as for anything else. As for doing good, that is one of the professions which are full. Moreover, I have tried it fairly, and, strange as it may seem, am satisfied that it does not agree with my constitution. Probably I should not consciously and deliberately forsake my particular calling to do the good which society demands of me, to save the universe from annihilation. And I believe that a like but infinitely greater steadfastness elsewhere is all that now preserves it. But I would not stand between any man and his genius. And to him who does this work, which I decline, with his whole heart and soul and life, I would say persevere, even if the world call it doing evil, as it is most likely they will. I am far from supposing that my case is a peculiar one. No doubt many of my readers would make a similar defense. At doing something, I will not engage that my neighbors shall pronounce it good, I do not hesitate to say that I should be a capital fellow to hire. But what that is, it is for my employer to find out. What good I do, in the common sense of that word, must be aside from my main path, and for the most part wholly unintended. Men say, practically, begin where you are and such as you are, without aiming mainly to become of more worth, and with kindness aforethought go about doing good. If I were to preach at all in this strain, I should say rather set about being good. As if the sun should stop when he had kindled his fires up to the splendor of a moon or a star of the sixth magnitude, and go about like Robin Goodfellow, peeping in at every cottage window, inspiring lunatics and tainting meats and making darkness visible, instead of steadily increasing his genial heat and beneficence till he is of such brightness that no mortal can look him in the face. And then, and in the meanwhile too, going about the world in his own orbit, doing it good, or rather, as a truer philosopher has discovered, the world going about him, getting good. When Phaeton, wishing to prove his heavenly birth by his beneficence, had the sun's chariot but one day, and drove out of the beaten track, he burned several blocks of houses in the lower streets of heaven, and scorched the surface of the earth, and dried up every spring, and made the great desert of Sahara, till at length Jupiter hurled him headlong to the earth with a thunderbolt, and the sun, through grief at his death, did not shine for a year. There is no odor so bad as that which arises from goodness tainted. It is human, it is divine carrion. If I knew for a certainty that a man was coming to my house with the conscious design of doing me good, I should run for my life, as from that dry and parching wind of the African deserts called the simoom, which fills the mouth and nose and ears and eyes with dust till you are suffocated, for fear that I should get some of his good done to me, some of its virus mingled with my blood. No, in this case I would rather suffer evil the natural way. A man is not a good man to me because he will feed me if I should be starving, or warm me if I should be freezing, or pull me out of a ditch if I should ever fall into one. I can find you a Newfoundland dog that will do as much. Philanthropy is not love for one's fellow man in the broadest sense. Howard was no doubt an exceedingly kind and worthy man in his way, and has his reward. But comparatively speaking, what are 100 Howards to us if their philanthropy do not help us in our best estate, when we are most worthy to be helped? I never heard of a philanthropic meeting in which it was sincerely proposed to do any good to me, or the like of me. The Jesuits were quite balked by those Indians who, being burned at the stake, suggested new modes of torture to their tormentors. Being superior to physical suffering, it sometimes chanced that they were superior to any consolation which the missionaries could offer, and the law to do as you would be done by fell with less persuasiveness on the ears of those who, for their part, did not care how they were done by, who loved their enemies after a new fashion, and came very near freely forgiving them all they did. Be sure that you give the poor the aid they most need, though it be your example which leaves them far behind. If you give money, spend yourself with it, and do not merely abandon it to them. We make curious mistakes sometimes. Often the poor man is not so cold and hungry as he is dirty and ragged and gross. It is partly his taste, and not merely his misfortune. If you give him money, he will perhaps buy more rags with it. I was wont to pity the clumsy Irish laborers who cut ice on the pond in such mean and ragged clothes, while I shivered in my more tidy and somewhat more fashionable garments, till, one bitter cold day, one who had slipped into the water came to my house to warm him, and I saw him strip off 3 pairs of pants and 2 pairs of stockings ere he got down to the skin. Though they were dirty and ragged enough, it is true, and that he could afford to refuse the extra garments which I offered him, he had so many intra ones. This ducking was the very thing he needed. Then I began to pity myself, and I saw that it would be a greater charity to bestow on me a flannel shirt than a whole slop shop on him. There are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to one who is striking at the root, and it may be that he who bestows the largest amount of time and money on the needy is doing the most by his mode of life to produce that misery which he strives in vain to relieve. It is the pious slave breeder, devoting the proceeds of every 10th slave to buy a Sunday's liberty for the rest. Some show their kindness to the poor by employing them in their kitchens. Would they not be kinder if they employed themselves there? You boast of spending a 10th part of your income in charity. Maybe you should spend the 9/10 so, and done with it. Society recovers only 1/10 part of the property then. Is this owing to the generosity of him in whose possession it is found, or to the remissness of the officers of justice? Philanthropy is almost the only virtue which is sufficiently appreciated by mankind. Nay, it is greatly overrated. It is our selfishness which overrates it. A robust poor man, one sunny day here in Concord, praised a fellow townsman to me because, as he said, he was kind to the poor, meaning himself. The kind uncles and aunts of the race are more esteemed than its true spiritual fathers and mothers. I once heard a reverend lecturer on England, a man of learning and intelligence, after enumerating her scientific, literary, and political worthies—Shakespeare, Bacon, Cromwell, Milton, Newton, and others—speak next of her Christian heroes, whom, as if his profession required it of him, he elevated to a place far above all the rest, as the greatest of the great. They were Penn, Howard, and Mrs. Fry. Everyone must feel the falsehood and cant of this. The last were not England's best men and women, only, perhaps, her best philanthropists. I would not subtract anything from the praise that is due to philanthropy, but merely demand justice for all who by their lives and works are a blessing to mankind. I do not value chiefly a man's uprightness and benevolence, which are, as it were, his stem and leaves. Those plants of whose greenness withered we make herb tea for the sick serve but a humble use, and are most employed by quacks. I want the flower and fruit of a man, that some fragrance be wafted over from him to me, and some ripeness flavor our intercourse. His goodness must not be a partial and transitory act, but a constant superfluity, which costs him nothing and of which he is unconscious. This is a charity that hides a multitude of sins. The philanthropist, too, often surrounds mankind with the remembrance of his own cast-off griefs as an atmosphere and calls it sympathy. We should impart our courage and not our despair, our health and ease and not our disease, and take care that this does not spread by contagion. From what southern plains comes up the voice of wailing? Under what latitudes reside the heathen to whom we would send light? Who is that intemperate and brutal man whom we would redeem? If anything ail a man, so that he does not perform his functions, if he have a pain in his bowels even, for that is the seat of sympathy, he forthwith sets about reforming the world. Being a microcosm himself, he discovers, and it is a true discovery, and he is the man to make it, that the world has been eating green apples. To his eyes, in fact, the globe itself is a great green apple, which there is a danger awful to think of, that the children of men will nibble before it is ripe. And straightway, his drastic philanthropy seeks out the Eskimo and the Patagonian and embraces the populous Indian and Chinese villages, and thus, by a few years of philanthropic activity, the powers in the meanwhile using him for their own ends, no doubt, he cures himself of his dyspepsia, the globe acquires a faint blush on one or both of its cheeks, as if it were beginning to be ripe, and life loses its crudity, and is once more sweet and wholesome to live. I never dreamed of an enormity greater than I have committed. I never knew, and never shall know, a worse man than myself. I believe that what so saddens the reformer is not his sympathy with his fellows in distress, but though he be the holiest son of God, is his private ail. Let this be righted, let the spring come to him, the morning rise over his couch, and he will forsake his generous companions without apology. My excuse for not lecturing against the use of tobacco is that I never chewed it. That is a penalty which reformed tobacco chewers have to pay. Though there are things enough I have chewed which I could lecture against. If you should ever be betrayed into any of these philanthropies, do not let your left hand know what your right hand does, for it is not worth knowing. Rescue the drowning and tie your shoestrings. Take your time and set about some free labor. Our manners have been corrupted by communication with the saints. Our hymn books resound with a melodious cursing of God and enduring him for ever. One would say that even the prophets and redeemers had rather consoled the fears than confirmed the hopes of man. There is nowhere recorded a simple and irrepressible satisfaction with the gift of life, any memorable praise of God. All health and success does me good, however far off and withdrawn it may appear. All disease and failure helps to make me sad and does me evil, however much sympathy it may have with me or I with it. If, then, we would indeed restore mankind by truly Indian, botanic, magnetic, or natural means, let us first be as simple and well as nature ourselves. Dispel the clouds which hang over our own brows, and take up a little life into our pores. Do not stay to be an overseer of the poor, but endeavor to become one of the worthies of the world. I read in the Gulistan, or Flower Garden, of Sheikh Sadi of Shiraz, that, quote, "They asked a wise man, saying, 'Of the many celebrated trees which the Most High God has created lofty and umbrageous, they call none azad, or free, excepting the cypress, which bears no fruit. What mystery is there in this?' he replied. Each has its appropriate produce, and appointing season, during the continuance of which it is fresh and blooming, and during their absence dry and withered, to neither of which states is the cypress exposed, being always flourishing, and of this nature are the azads or religious independence. Fix not thy heart on that which is transitory, for the Dijla or Tigris will continue to flow through Baghdad after the race of caliphs is extinct. If thy hand has plenty, be liberal as the date tree, but if it affords nothing to give away, be an azad, or free man, like the cypress." Complimental Verses. The Pretensions of Poverty. Quote, "Thou dost presume too much, poor needy wretch, to claim a station in the firmament, because thy humble cottage or thy tub nurses some lazy or pedantic virtue in the cheap sunshine or by shady springs, with roots and pot herbs, where thy right hand, tearing those humane passions from the mind, upon whose stalks fair blooming virtues flourish, degradeth nature and benumbeth sense, and Gorgon-like turns active men to stone. We not require the dull society of your necessitated temperance, or that unnatural stupidity that knows nor joy nor sorrow, nor your forced, falsely exalted passive fortitude above the active. This low abject brood that fix their seats in mediocrity become your servile minds. But we advance such virtues only as admit excess. Brave, bounteous acts, regal magnificence, all-seeing prudence, magnanimity that knows no bound, and that heroic virtue for which antiquity hath left no name, but patterns only, such as Hercules, Achilles, Theseus. Back to thy loathed cell, and when thou seest the new enlightened sphere, study to know but what those worthies were." End quote. T. Carew.
Now, let's hear another question from Daniel Swalo's FAQ. This is how he answers those who think because he doesn't have money, he must be poor. He must be somehow lacking and going without.
Question 18. Isn't it hard living your life of asceticism? Well, by the common definition of ascetic, I'm not an ascetic. I live the life of abundance. There's nothing I don't need or want but what is right here and now. When I lived with money, I was always lacking. Money represents lack. Money represents things in the past, debt, and things in the future, credit. But money never represents what is present. If a dollar bill represented itself, it would no longer be money. It would simply be a piece of paper with pretty art on it. To be bound to money and possessions is asceticism, self-flagellation, lack, need, debt. Forgive us our debts, even as we forgive our debtors. To be released from money and possessions is freedom, the end of self-hurt, the end of lack, the end of debt, the beginning of wealth. To accumulate stuff is to take on poverty and suffering. Why own mansions and cars and lands when you can own the whole universe? When you own nothing, you own everything. When you own a house and stuff, you have to be in your house and have your stuff to be secure. When you give up your house and stuff, then you start to realize that every place is your home, everything is yours. There is no place where you can go, where you're not home. There's nobody you have to fear. You find that everything you need is right at hand, and everybody becomes familiar, becomes family. You can love your neighbor as yourself, because your neighbor is yourself, and everybody becomes your neighbor. All that I'm saying, you know by direct experience, direct proof. Deep down, you know that it's impossible to enjoy the things you have if you take more than you need. Eat just enough candy, and it's delicious, it's wealth. Eat too much candy, and it's sickening, it's poverty. Our society has become sickening. Those who take only what they need are wealthy. Those who take more than they need are in poverty. Taking more than you need betrays you. If you don't think you're lacking, then why would you take more than you need? Stop being needy. Nobody sincerely likes being around a needy person. Faith is realizing everything you need is right here and right now. If your hand is grasping something, it can't be open to receive the next blessing. Take climbing a ladder. It takes faith to let go of one rung of the ladder to reach the next rung. Climbing is faith. It takes faith to lift your foot off the ground to take a step. You take walking for granted, but every step you take is balancing on the brink of disaster. It's only because of grace and faith that you can walk. Give up possessions. Start trusting. Be grateful. Be graceful. Be generous. Be open. Start walking. Then walking becomes automatic, natural. This is faith. Every particle in the universe is walking. Every particle in the universe runs on faith. That which doesn't run on faith is illusion and delusion. So get out of delusion and join the universe. Start enjoying life. In Old English, want means lack. To want is to lack, and to lack is to want. When you trust that everything in the universe is under sovereign control without your manipulation, then that 23rd psalm you hear on Hollywood funerals will finally take on meaning, and you can say, I shall not want. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for somebody who takes more than she or he needs to enter into the present moment.
Now, let's hear a snatch of part 5 of The Corruption of Christianity. This is Ivan Illich speaking on renunciation as a Christian discipline and a way to help one appreciate life.
and not give up because we want a more beautiful life, but because we want to become aware of how much we are attached to the world as it is, and how much we can get along without it. These things have multiplied so much that you can't easily give a social shape to them. Some people will give up writing letters on a computer. Not because it's bad, and not because they don't like to be called upon to give an immediate answer for a letter which they got email. And other people will give up the services of physicians. Or as somebody whom I know has practiced it, having children of whom he guarantees that they'll get degrees. The certainty that I can get along without is one of the most efficacious ways of convincing yourself, no matter where you stand on the intellectual or emotional ladder, that you are free. Renunciation, self-imposed limits, are the basis for a practice that prepares people, perhaps even politically, to discuss what kind of limits do we want to impose on ourselves as a group of 2, 5, 12 friends, or perhaps as a neighborhood. Realizing that we can do that, realizing that we can practice renunciation, I have seen, I can witness to it for the last 15 or 20 years, is for many people who suffer from great fears and sense of impotence and depersonalization, a very simple way back to a self which stands above the constraints of the world.
A contemporary practice of renunciation, Illich says, is the opposite of mortification or asceticism, or any of the other terms one might associate with ideologically founded self-denial. Rather, it is a precondition for enjoyment, for a sober joy in those things within my personal reach. By renunciation, we open ourselves to what Illich calls gratuity, the spirit in which we receive a gift. And it is in this spirit of praise and thanksgiving, he says, that he hopes to live.
Since I live in this world, I couldn't find a better world to live with those whom I love. And those are exactly people who overwhelmingly are aware of the fact that we are beyond the threshold, who are not anymore so deeply imbued by the spirit of utility or instrumentality that they wouldn't be able to understand what I mean by gratuity. I do believe that there is a way of being understood today when you speak about gratuity. And gratuity, in the most beautiful flowering, is praise, mutual enjoyment. And what some people, such as those who propose a new orthodoxy, discover is that the message of Christianity is that we live together, praising the fact that we are where we are and who we are. And that contrition and forgiveness are part of that which we celebrate doxologically.
With praise.
Yeah.
Chapter 2. Where I Lived and What I Lived For. At a certain season of our lives, we are accustomed to consider every spot as the possible site of a house. I have thus surveyed the country on every side within a dozen miles of where I live. In imagination I have bought all the farms in succession, for all were to be bought, and I knew their price. I walked over each farmer's premises, tasted his wild apples, discoursed on husbandry with him, took his farm at his price, at any price, mortgaging it to him in my mind, even put a higher price on it, took everything but a deed of it, took his word for his deed, for I dearly loved to talk, cultivated it, and him too, to some extent, I trust, and withdrew when I had enjoyed it long enough, leaving him to carry it on. This experience entitled me to be regarded as a sort of real estate broker by my friends. Wherever I sat, there I might live, and the landscape radiated from me accordingly. What is a house but a sedes, a seat? Better if a country seat. I discovered many a site for a house not likely to be soon improved, which some might have thought too far from the village, but to my eyes the village was too far from it. Well, there I might live, I said, and there I did live, for an hour, a summer, and a winter life, saw how I could let the years run off, buffet the winter through, and see the spring come in. The future inhabitants of this region, wherever they may place their houses, may be sure that they have been anticipated. An afternoon sufficed to lay out the land into orchard, woodlot, and pasture, and to decide what fine oaks or pines should be left to stand before the door, and whence each blasted tree could be seen to the best advantage. And then I let it lie, fallow, perchance, for a man is rich in proportion to the number of things which he can afford to let alone. My imagination carried me so far that I even had the refusal of several farms. The refusal was all I wanted. But I never got my fingers burned by actual possession. The nearest that I came to actual possession was when I bought the Hollowell place, and had begun to sort my seeds, and collected materials with which to make a wheelbarrow to carry it on or off with. But before the owner gave me a deed of it, his wife—every man has such a wife—changed her mind, and wished to keep it, and he offered me $10 to release him. Now, to speak the truth, I had but 10 cents in the world, and it surpassed my arithmetic to tell if I was that man who had 10 cents, or who had a farm, or $10, or all together. However, I let him keep the $10, and the farm too, for I had carried it far enough. Or rather, to be generous, I sold him the farm for just what I gave for it, and, as he was not a rich man, made him a present of $10. And still had my 10 cents, and seeds, and materials for a wheelbarrow left. I found thus that I had been a rich man, without any damage to my poverty, but I retained the landscape, and I have since annually carried off what it yielded without a wheelbarrow. With respect to landscapes, quote, I am monarch of all I survey, my right there is none to dispute. End quote. I have frequently seen a poet withdraw, having enjoyed the most valuable part of a farm, while the crusty farmer supposed that he had got a few wild apples only. Why, the owner does not know it for many years, when a poet has put his farm in rhyme, the most admirable kind of invisible fence, has fairly impounded it, milked it, skimmed it, and got all the cream, and left the farmer only the skimmed milk. The real attractions of the Hollowell farm to me were its complete retirement, being about 2 miles from the village, half a mile from the nearest neighbor, and separated from the highway by a broad field. Its bounding on the river, which the owner said protected it by its fogs from frosts in the spring, though that was nothing to me. The gray color and ruinous state of the house and barn, and the dilapidated fences, which put such an interval between me and the last occupant. The hollow and lichen-covered apple trees, gnawed by rabbits, showing what kind of neighbors I should have. But above all, the recollection I had of it from my earliest voyages up the river, when the house was concealed behind a dense grove of red maples, through which I heard the house dog bark. I was in haste to buy it, before the proprietor finished getting out some rocks, cutting down the hollow apple trees, and grubbing up some young birches which had sprung up in the pasture, or, in short, had made any more of his improvements. To enjoy these advantages, I was ready to carry it on, like Atlas, to take the world on my shoulders. I never heard what compensation he received for that, and do all those things which had no other motive or excuse but that I might pay for it and be unmolested in my possession of it, for I knew all the while that it would yield the most abundant crop of the kind I wanted, if I could only afford to let it alone. But it turned out as I have said. All that I could say, then, with respect to farming on a large scale—I have always cultivated a garden—was that I had my seeds ready. Many think that seeds improve with age. I have no doubt that time discriminates between the good and the bad, and when at last I shall plant, I shall be less likely to be disappointed. But I would say to my fellows, once for all, as long as possible, live free and uncommitted. It makes but little difference whether you are committed to a farm or the county jail. Chapter 2, Part 2. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear, nor did I wish to practice resignation, unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms, and, if it proved to be mean, why then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it, and publish its meanness to the world, or, if it were sublime, to know it by experience, and be able to give a true account of it in my next excursion. For most men, it appears to me, are in a strange uncertainty about it, whether it is of the devil or of God, and have somewhat hastily concluded that it is the chief end of man here to, quote, glorify God and enjoy him forever, end quote. Still, we live meanly, like ants, though the fable tells us that we were long ago changed into men. Like pygmies, we fight with cranes. It is error upon error, and clout upon clout, and our best virtue has for its occasion a superfluous and evitable wretchedness. Our life is frittered away by detail. An honest man has hardly need to count more than his 10 fingers, or, in extreme cases, he may add his 10 toes, and lump the rest. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity! I say, let your affairs be as 2 or 3, and not 100 or 1,000. Instead of 1,000,000, count 6, and keep your accounts on your thumbnail. In the midst of this chopping sea of civilized life, such are the clouds and storms and quicksands and 1,001 items to be allowed for, that a man has to live, if he would not founder and go to the bottom and not make his port at all, by dead reckoning, and he must be a great calculator indeed who succeeds. Simplify, simplify. Instead of 3 meals a day, if it be necessary, eat but 1. instead of 100 dishes? 5. And reduce other things in proportion. Our life is like a German confederacy, made up of petty states, with its boundary forever fluctuating, so that even a German cannot tell you how it is bounded at any moment. The nation itself, with all its so-called internal improvements, which, by the way, are all external and superficial, is just such an unwieldy and overgrown establishment, cluttered with furniture and tripped up by its own traps, ruined by luxury and heedless expense, by want of calculation and a worthy aim, as a million households in the land. And the only cure for it, as for them, is in rigid economy, a stern and more than Spartan simplicity of life and elevation of purpose. It lives too fast. Men think that it is essential that the nation have commerce and export ice and talk through a telegraph and ride 30 miles an hour, without a doubt, whether they do or not. But whether we should live like baboons or like men is a little uncertain. If we do not get out sleepers and forge rails and devote days and nights to the work, but go to tinkering upon our lives to improve them, who will build railroads? And if railroads are not built, how shall we get to heaven in season? But if we stay at home and mind our business, who will want railroads? We do not ride on the railroad. It rides upon us. Did you ever think what those sleepers are that underlie the railroad? Each one is a man, an Irishman, or a Yankee man. The rails are laid on them, and they are covered with sand, and the cars run smoothly over them. They are sound sleepers, I assure you. And every few years a new lot is laid down and run over, so that if some have the pleasure of riding on a rail, others have the misfortune to be ridden upon. And when they run over a man that is walking in his sleep, a supernumerary sleeper in the wrong position, and wake him up, they suddenly stop the cars and make a hue and cry about it, as if this were an exception. I am glad to know that it takes a gang of men for every 5 miles to keep the sleepers down and level in their beds, as it is, for this is a sign that they may sometime get up again. Why should we live with such hurry and waste of life? We are determined to be starved before we are hungry. Men say that a stitch in time saves 9, and so they take 1,000 stitches today to save 9 tomorrow. As for work, we haven't any of any consequence. We have the St. Vitus dance, and cannot possibly keep our heads still. If I should only give a few pulls at the parish bell rope, as for a fire, that is, without setting the bell, there is hardly a man on his farm in the outskirts of Concord, notwithstanding that press of engagements which was his excuse so many times this morning, nor a boy nor a woman, I might almost say, but would forsake all and follow that sound, not mainly to save property from the flames, but, if we will confess the truth, much more to see it burn, since burn it must. And we, be it known, did not set it on fire, or to see it put out, and have a hand in it, if that is done as handsomely. Yes, even if it were the parish church itself. Hardly a man takes a half-hour's nap after dinner, but when he wakes he holds up his head and asks, "What's the news?" as if the rest of mankind had stood his sentinels. Some give directions to be waked every half-hour, doubtless for no other purpose, and then to pay for it they tell what they have dreamed. After a night's sleep the news is as indispensable as the breakfast. "Pray tell me anything new that has happened to a man anywhere on this globe." And he reads it over his coffee and rolls, that a man has had his eyes gouged out this morning on the Wachito River, never dreaming the while that he lives in the dark, unfathomed mammoth cave of this world, and has but the rudiment of an eye himself. For my part, I could easily do without the post-office. I think that there are very few important communications made through it. To speak critically, I never received more than one or two letters in my life, I wrote this some years ago, that were worth the postage. The penny post is, commonly, an institution through which you seriously offer a man that penny for his thoughts which is so often safely offered in jest. And I am sure that I never read any memorable news in a newspaper. If we read of one man robbed, or murdered, or killed by accident, or one house burned, or one vessel wrecked, or one steamboat blown up, or one cow run over on the Western Railroad, or one mad dog killed, or one lot of grasshoppers in the winter, we never need read of another. One is enough. If you are acquainted with the principle, what do you care for a myriad instances and applications? To a philosopher, all news, as it is called, is gossip, and they who edit and read it are old women over their tea. Yet not a few are greedy after this gossip. There was such a rush, as I hear, the other day, at one of the offices to learn the foreign news by the last arrival, that several large squares of plate glass belonging to the establishment were broken by the pressure. News which I seriously think a ready wit might write a 12-month or 12 years beforehand with sufficient accuracy. As for Spain, for instance, if you know how to throw in Don Carlos and the Infanta, and Don Pedro and Seville and Granada from time to time in the right proportions, they may have changed the names a little since I saw the papers, and serve up a bullfight when other entertainments fail, it will be true to the letter, and give us as good an idea of the exact state or ruin of things in Spain as the most succinct and lucid reports under this head in the newspapers. And as for England, almost the last significant scrap of news from that quarter was the Revolution of 1649. And if you have learned the history of her crops for an average year, you never need attend to that thing again, unless your speculations are of a merely pecuniary character. If one may judge, who rarely looks into the newspapers, nothing new does ever happen in foreign parts, a French Revolution not excepted. What news? How much more important to know what that is which was never old. Quote, Kiyu Hiyu, great dignitary of the state of Wei, sent a man to Gong Tsiu to know his news. Gong Tsiu caused the messenger to be seated near him, and questioned him in these terms. What is your master doing? The messenger answered with respect. My master desires to diminish the number of his faults, but he cannot come to the end of them. The messenger being gone, the philosopher remarked, What a worthy messenger! What a worthy messenger! End quote. The preacher, instead of vexing the ears of drowsy farmers on their day of rest at the end of the week, for Sunday is the fit conclusion of an ill-spent week, and not the fresh and brave beginning of a new one, with this one other draggle tale of a sermon, should shout with thundering voice, "Pause! Avast! Why so seeming fast, but deadly slow?" Shams and delusions are esteemed for soundest truths, while reality is fabulous. If men would steadily observe realities only, and not allow themselves to be deluded, life, to compare it with such things as we know, would be like a fairy tale and the Arabian Nights' entertainments. If we respected only what is inevitable and has a right to be, music and poetry would resound along the streets. When we are unhurried and wise, we perceive that only great and worthy things have any permanent and absolute existence, that petty fears and petty pleasures are but the shadow of the reality. This is always exhilarating and sublime. By closing the eyes and slumbering, and consenting to be deceived by shows, men establish and confirm their daily life of routine and habit everywhere, which still is built on purely illusory foundations. Children who play life discern its true law and relations more clearly than men who fail to live it worthily, but who think that they are wiser by experience, that is, by failure. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Hey.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life.
For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of sh** when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true.
This and all previous episodes are available for download from the Unwelcome Guests MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope you found this show an inspiration and that it's helped put a smile on your face and face life with a grin, whatever your individual circumstances, to give all you can and to take what you need.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Best things happen to see, you know.
Always look on the bright side of life.
I mean, what you gotta lose? You know, you come from nothing, you're going back to nothing.